speaking about cool people, a tribute to the next speaker is that it's jam-packed, even though it's very late in the day. We got so many mails and calls after the last show he put on here, saying he must come back this year. So I talked to Andreas, I said, would you come back and do another Andreas Wegen show for us? And he said, yes, I'd love to do that. I want to invite a guest. I said, okay, could you... And I said, what kind of guest would you like me to invite? I said, well, find somebody, you know, I know people all over the world. He said, you know, I can bring anyone. I said, okay, find somebody smarter than yourself. And then he said, that's more difficult. And he looked around and said, well, then there's not so many people that I can call, but I know one guy that if I can get him to come, he sure fills those shoes. So I'm not going to stand here and talk. I'm going to start the Andreas Wegen Show.
Thank you, Ola. Thank you. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, there I was yesterday at the airport in Düsseldorf, checking in. And I was checking in, and I then moved to the next airport, changing planes in Munich, and they said, hello, Mr. Weigand. I said, how do you know it's Mr. Weigand? I said, well, when you checked in Düsseldorf, we read your RFID tags in your suit. And now we know that it might not be you, but it's at least the suit you were wearing. So I thought, gee, that's a bit scary now they know who I am. But at least I won't lose my suit. And then it continued. Then I was at the Metro Future store. Metro is a company in Düsseldorf. And as you walk through the store, you are looking at some item, maybe the cream cheese, and you think, well, you know, I'll be at stage tomorrow. Maybe the low-fat version is better, and you take the low-fat cream cheese. And as you walk more through the aisle, some dieting pills start blinking at you because they know that you just looked at the low-fat cream cheese. And then you check out. Actually, you don't need to check out because, of course, they know everything which is in your cart. And they, of course, know everything which, you know, you have paid before. So then I realized what's really scary to us in the real world was day one at Amazon.com. That at day one, Amazon needed to know what to show to you. So now, coming from having been chief scientist at Amazon.com, coming from that online world and realizing how our expectations dramatically differ in the real world from the virtual world, I really, really thought about, you know, what does it mean to us? What does it mean to our privacy as well? Because online, let me ask you, who of you would be willing to, for let's say 10,000 kronas, have every single search he or she did at Google appear here on that screen? Okay, have you done any searches?
Yes.
Okay, there are two people in the audience, 10,000 kronas, interesting. So normally people would be much more comfortable if all their short messages were made public than if all their searches were their whole, these conversations about their most private moments with the computer. Even at Amazon, I remember, we sometimes looked at what people in their shopping carts. And I remember Jeff Bezos really cracking up one day when we looked at what people buy together. And there was that book, you know, if it's not working in marriage anymore, you know, little bit, you know, pieces of advice. And there was this other book, and then there was this other book on how to have a vacation in Thailand. So I guess that was their plan B in case the first one didn't work. So what I want to say here is that online, you know an incredible amount about people, their wishes, their desires. What I want to talk about today is what are these attention gestures online? How can we build models based on these attention gestures, such as just to save an item, to put in your wish list, or if you're reading blog posts, you rate something, you vote for something, you tag something, you annotate that. Or maybe you forward it to a friend. So how can we collect those attention gestures in order for you to get basically a better life, for you to, from the plethora of things you could see, to see those things which you might be interested in. But for that personalization, ladies and gentlemen, what actually do we give up for that? So when, as Ola said, when I was thinking about who can I invite, who really has a deep understanding of privacy, of what it means, I thought about David Holtzman. David, I met about a decade ago when he had a company which was dealing with pseudonyms called Opion, where you could have insight into, like Esther Dyson said this morning, into the data others are collecting about you, and maybe you are able to actually edit those data. David and I, we did workshops at Amazon and the startups and a whole pair of things and had wonderful conversations over the years about privacy and interesting things. So he actually, going back a little bit, used to be the chief scientist at IBM in the 90s. And the 80s, mid-80s, he did some interesting work actually not far away from here. David was a spy. David was a spy for the Americans. And he actually, the real word is, he was a cryptographic analyst, in case you didn't know what that meant. So he went to school in Monterey, learned all kinds of languages like Russian and so on and so forth, and hang out in submarines and trying to figure out what privacy things were going on there. So it's a great pleasure to introduce here David Holtzman. And David, have a seat. I would like to start with a question and asking you. I hear that a certain client, and I can't talk about who it is, asked you to have a lady disappear for a week, a couple of months ago in San Francisco.
It's an internet magic trick.
Okay, how did you have that lady disappear for a week?
Well, I do things involving privacy and identity, and this is one of the odder ones. The assignment was to be untraceable, untrackable in the middle of San Francisco for a week, and this is assuming that someone had access to all the sensors that are available, which some people do, I don't. So we had to hypothesize. So the first thing we did was I told her she had to get rid of her computer. And we went through a couple of days of arguing about this. We went through, we looked at her log files, we looked at disk caching, we looked at records of search, and we decided, unfortunately, it was a Windows box, just to make it worse, and it was almost impossible to clean the machine. So we decided, rather than then, of course, for those of you techies in the audience, then you have stuff that's been deleted but is still on the hard drive somewhere, and our forensic data person could recover, which is, I can tell you lots of stories about that. So we got rid of the computer, I made her get rid of the cell phone, we got one of those pay-as-you-go cell phone things. I told her she had to use free Wi-Fi nets because she couldn't use a credit card. Then we had to trace a route through San Francisco that wouldn't get in front of a camera, and that turned out to be almost impossible. There's almost a million cameras in San Francisco. They're in almost every convenience store, bank, government building, traffic light. It's virtually impossible. Then she had to wear a sun visor and a scarf because it turns out they have facial recognition systems employed in some of the government buildings. And if you hide the earlobes and some of the face shape, you have a chance of getting away with it. She went to cyber cafes. I told her don't use the bathroom. Wear gloves. Don't eat any DNA samples. Anyway.
Why not use the bathroom?
Well, because someone could collect DNA samples. I mean, this is the extreme. This is an experiment just to see how bad it was. It was pretty bad. By the end of the week, she was absolutely miserable. She hadn't been able to talk to any of her friends. She hadn't been eating very well, and it took her hours to go 4 or 5 blocks because she had to take the circuitous path. And you couldn't do it in London. It would be absolutely impossible to do it in London.
So underlying this are a couple of trends. Namely, sensing has become so ubiquitous. For instance, your mobile phone. Think about it. Your mobile phone knows where you are. Even if it doesn't have GPS, it has cell tower triangulation. Your mobile phone knows how you're feeling because your voice, it has a microphone in it, your voice sounds differently whether you're feeling good or whether you're in trouble. Your mobile phone, of course, knows what the surroundings are like because there's a camera in it. Your mobile phone knows who your friends are. Who do you push to voicemail? Who do you answer right away? Who do you answer if you're afraid to talk? Your mobile phone knows whether you're late because it's calendar, and all these things. Your mobile phone knows an incredible sums of things about you. Yet, it is so stupid.
Actually,
it either rings or it doesn't ring.
In the US since 2005, all cell phones are by law have to be locatable even if you're not using the cell phone.
Okay, so your phone is really stupid. So when are we actually getting phones that sense what situation we are in? The other day, like 2 weeks ago, I installed the new Flash 9 and I got a message from Amazon Web Services, AWS. It said, in order to do a better service for you, like make better recommendations, would you allow us access to your camera and your microphone in your laptop? I said, whoa, Amazon asks me whether they can look at whatever is in my room and whatever sounds I'm making here in order to send me better recommendations. That was interesting. Flash 9 allows you.
Did you say
say yes?
I of course said yes, because I always like to try things. So what are the underlying trends here? It's besides digitizing everything, storing everything.
Well, you've got cheap storage. I mean, everybody knows about this, but let's just put it in perspective. You know, Moore's Law, cheap sensors, CCD cameras, very, very cheap. That's why they fit into a cell phone. Storage, it's almost always cheaper to buy hard drive than it is to figure out what to delete. And if you work in a company and you ask your lawyer what to delete, I guarantee you'll just buy another hard drive and just add it on. So you got cheap storage, you got cheap sensing devices. You have one, basically the whole world's become one network, I would argue. You don't have separate.
TJ Watson said, well, we might need three computers in the world. So what you're saying is he got it wrong.
No, he got it
wrong.
Too many. Too many, right. I mean, effectively, for all practical purposes, even the most highly classified government computers are obliquely hooked up to the internet. Medical diagnostic devices are on the internet. And now, as you know, chips have Wi-Fi capability built onto the chip, like the Centrino, then it just happens. So also add to that the fact that there really isn't anything that's data security. People talk about security. Security is a goal, not an absolute, right? There is no computer or computer system that you can't get into if you want to spend enough time. And if you don't believe me, ask Sony about Blu-ray. So that got hacked within 2 days, I think, after being put out. So you put all those facts together, and what you come up with is the fact that it's all data is knowable. There is no privacy.
There's no privacy. Get over it. As you know,
Scott McNeely said.
Exactly. So if there's no privacy, let's actually make a little distinction here. So what is the difference between what we have now, for instance, at Facebook? Half of my students of a Stanford course ended up working for Facebook both last year and this year. So Facebook versus, let's say, glorified resume services like LinkedIn or Xing. The difference is, I believe, that the old world, the Xings, the LinkedIns, it is you who provides the information, and it's you who changes the information. You know, it has happened more than once that an engineer from one of the startups I'm involved in, you know, a couple of years down the road, he was the VP of engineering, where he came just in as a junior developer at the time. People just change their things, and I always wish that extra button telling me, tell me, how did that person's resume evolve over time? But it's about that person. Facebook is different. Facebook is not about the node, but it's about the arcs. It's about the connections the person has. Sometimes we say this is generation C.
I wonder if most of Web 2.0 is about that. It's about the arcs, not about the nodes.
Yeah.
Web 1.0 is about the nodes. Web 2.0 is about the arcs.
It's about the arcs. Now, if you think about this, arcs are true stickiness because there's no way I can get my 20, 200, 2,000 best friends, whatever I have on Facebook, to all move to the next platform. Whereas I have no problem moving my Amazon profile to Beamazon or Cimazon.
But you know, you're talking about voluntarily contributed information. Part of the problem now is there's information that's coming in that we didn't ask for. And I'll give you an example. I was trying to get some money out of an E-Trade account a couple of weeks ago. I called E-Trade and they said, we want to ask you a question, after they got my normal identity, birthday kind of thing. They said, here's a land transaction made by this person. Tell us where the land was. Well, it was, I was divorced 12 years ago, and my ex-wife had bought some land and sold it, apparently, a couple years ago. And they had data match and demanded that I tell them what my ex-wife had sold or bought. And I said, I don't know, it's none of my business, and this is a ridiculous question. And I had to go all the way up the line to be able to get somebody to validate my transaction. We're going to see more of that, because as more data gets bought, more data gets integrated, data never disappears. Once somebody buys data and integrates it into a database, they're not going to segregate it again.
In German, we have a word called informationelle Selbstbestimmung. I don't know whether there's a Swedish word for that. It's a good word.
It means
that it's, you know, you have the right to determine the information about yourself. Who has access to this? You have the right to keep certain identities parallel. And when we talk identities, maybe we should drill down a little bit. And there is anonymous stuff, and that's tended to be bad, because if people have no repercussions, they tend to say random bad stuff. Dave and I are both big fans of pseudonymity. That means you have persistent history. You don't need to be knowing my real name. That would be stronger authentication, or even my fingerprint which would be very strong authentication. But in my case, a pseudonym, A. Weigand. I mean, just, you know, having something which might, you know, be good.
I believe this is one of the next wave of business things. It's going to be identity-related things. I heard a speaker two talks ago talking about reputation and why you can't just use money as a currency. I think reputation is the new currency. I think pseudonymity is the next identity play. And I think identity is going to be one of the next big businesses. Because when you look at everything going on in the internet, there's one odd thing that really hasn't been dealt with. I mean, it's an identity. Many of us still use email address, or Andreas argues, I think you argued, the cell phone number as identity. Those are silly things to identify yourself with. What I think that we're going to start doing is using persistent, by persistent, I mean decades, long pseudonyms that can't be broken, that you create when you're young, that you keep when you're old, and you keep the segregation of those identities separate from your real identity, because it can turn around and hurt you. If you want to be able to give opinions on something, you don't necessarily want those opinions on the online world to reverberate back and have repercussions in the real world. So I think we're going to see a huge amount of trade, and probably built on OpenID or some other kind of open identity standard.
I spent some time in Asia. I actually was the only investor in the Chinese knockoff of Facebook, Xiaomi, which we sold last year. And just last Friday, a Thai company called Agoda was sold to Priceline. And I noticed that Thailand throttles its internet bandwidth at night. So I drill down, why is this the case, given that Agoda servers sit there? And the answer is that there are thousands, 10,000 of Thai kids who all play computer games, but not because, you know, they enjoy it, but they create identities on World of Warcraft, which they then sell.
It's a big business. If anybody plays RPGs, online role-playing games, what these kids do is they take a blank identity and they build it up to what's like a level 8 or a level 10, and then they sell it. So a busy guy who doesn't want to get on and wait for months to actually get a sword, you know, gets online. And there's big money here. I mean, there's millions of dollars every year now in artifacts in the online gaming industry.
What I want to do is I wanted to get ready, because I'm really part of Generation C. You know what Generation C is? Connectivity. Co-creation. Very important element for me. Community. All these C words, I think, are part of Generation C. So this co-creation part is an important one for me. So if you want to get ready for karaoke microphones, I think they are here. Think about some questions you might have while I'm asking Dave. So in this world here, what strategies do you think, besides wearing visors and getting new SIM cards, what I did yesterday, not using your card because you came to dinner, what other ways do we have to actually cope with these interesting two sides of the coin of wanting personalized service, yet maybe wanting to keep that personality in the dungeons apart from that personality on stage?
Mm-hmm. Well, I also have a book out now called Privacy Lost, and I went into a lot of detail on that book. I think there's five basic strategies that people do to protect their privacy. The first one is they just ignore it and pretend it's not happening to them, which is what a lot of people do. The second thing that people do is they try to avoid it. They don't go into situations where they have to give too much personal information, either in the real world or on the internet. And then the third one, which I actually like a lot, is you lie, right? I'm sure whoever lies, like, okay, that's great. You know what, when they ask you, do you want to buy like a battery online, and they want your mother's name, your social security number, you get disgusted and you just start typing ones in? Okay, I do that all the time. That's lying. So I gave a talk last week at a school, and a Catholic priest stood up and he goes, I do that. And everybody attacked him. They said, well, how can you lie? He goes, it's not lying. I just can't deal with the bastards anymore. So the fourth strategy you can do is the one I do, and I call it being a curmudgeon, which is if someone asks me for information, I say no. I say, why do you need that? I call up the manager and I say, why do you need this information? And then the last...
The story for that is, Dave and I went to a restaurant, I think somewhere in America, New York, and the lady at the entrance, the maitre d', said, what's your name? And Dave said, that's none of your business. And was then surprised.
Well, it wasn't. The fifth thing you can do is you can be a vigilante and you can attack, and there are people that are doing that, and I can tell you more about that. But then there's another strategy. Now, let me ask you a question, Andreas. Now, I know on your website, you publish exactly where you are in the world. That terrifies me. I would never do that. I won't. You go to his website, and it'll say, I'm catching this plane, and I'm going to be in this city at such and such a time. I think that's an absolutely unique way of dealing with privacy, and I would never do it. Does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me. And actually here, I would like to announce that I'm going to pay 500 euros for a person who is willing to take any of the mobile phones I have an old area of them, maybe with a GPS. I'm even willing to buy a new one, like the N95 or something like this, if they can write something which updates on my blog, on Weigand.com, in maybe real time, a 10-minute delay, just where I have last been seen. So just my route to the world. So 500 euros cash, I have the money with me, if somebody is willing to actually write that piece of code. And I think that's one way, because, hey, if there's any trouble by, I'm just showing a different strategy here, basically, sixth strategy,
yeah,
by saying, look at, I was here, I was here, I was here, I was here, and here I intersected with Ola at 4 o'clock in the morning, that bar. So I couldn't have whatever you're pretending I've been doing, done that. So that is one other way of dealing with
the alibi strategy. That's interesting. If there's someone invents it, I would pay them not to do it for me.
I was of course saying that it is my phone which is there, so I just have to rent somebody for another $20 and put their phone.
That's why you think a person is their phone. See, this is why I propose a different kind of pseudonymity. Back in the late 90s, I worked at Network Solutions. I was the CTO, and I ran the domain name system. And the domain names at the time were a way of naming networks, big machine cluster things. But now we need a way of doing that for people. And I just don't think your phone number is good enough. I think we need something better.
Any questions from you guys? Here in Scandinavia, where phones were invented, Nokia has more brand recognition in the world than Finland, I learned.
Is that true?
Yes. In Sweden, Sime has more recognition than Stockholm, I think. Here's a question.
I think that's a good observation. I'm working on a book now about the generational difference in privacy. So baby boomers, you know, people in their late 40s and 50s, tend to be really appalled at almost all of this discussion. They're the ones who say, I don't know why my kids are in MySpace. Oh my God, I can't believe they're talking about their dates, right? But then you got Gen Y and Gen X. I think that's a Gen Y attitude, which is that they don't care so much. But I think they're going to care. And it's because a lot of this digital information, it's like the nastiest, ugliest tattoo that you ever got on your drum when you were in college that looked really good for about 3 or 4 months, and then you look at it and you say, oh my God, why is that? You know, like, cut along the dotted line along your neck, or, you know, an old girlfriend all the way up your back. That's what it's going to be like. So I've already seen this with people that are in their late 20s that have been doing this stuff most of their life, and they really regret having some of that information, especially I can only imagine the kind of pictures you're looking at.
But an alternative view would be that, hey, I'll show you yours if you show somebody else's mine. So, or whatever the saying is, something like that, right? That...
You know, there's a new kind of a privacy crime that's been going on with, I call it synthesized pornography, where somebody takes a picture and photoshops it to make it look like it's pornography, but it's like you take somebody's head and you put it on a porn picture, and there's a bunch of that. In the U.S., there's been like 2 or 3 legal cases on that already. I mean, I don't even know what you call that. That's not a crime in most countries, I know.
Okay, another couple of questions. Esther. Interesting question.
You try first,
So links are binary. There is a link or there is no link. That is Web 2. For me, this notion of having a fixed number of friends and even, you know, them being symmetrical is a very archaic, simplistic notion, just as simplistic as my phone that either rings or it doesn't ring. So for me, having much richer metadata, typed links, as you say nicely, that certainly is a step in the right direction. So if you think about communication, it's pretty pathetic that we have very little ways of, with low footprint, just effortlessly, letting many friends know what we are doing. There are some ways like Twitter, and you know, I don't know, maybe 50, 100 people are following you on Twitter, probably wanting to know what you're saying, but there is not much metadata there. So there are lots of people interested in what we are doing, but we want to have some richer metadata. For instance, we could do it in a predictive way. I could say, hey Esther, I think this company is really, really interesting for you. Give it a 9 out of 10. And Esther looks and says, forget it, Andreas has one of these lame companies once again, and gives it to. So I slowly go down with the reputation. So having predictions combined with reputation, and it doesn't even matter that it's me, a pseudonym is good enough for that,
right.
I think is some direction where we are going.
I think I agree with what both of you are saying. I would call weighted arcs, but it's the same thing as tags earlier. I think there'll be numeric quotients and reputational. So for instance, you know, one of the things that people, I used to teach graduate business classes at a college a couple years ago, and it would appall me because the younger students would send in papers, and I'd look at the bibliography, and they would cite the internet in capital P, capital I, of course. And then the really good ones would put the year, so they'd say the internet 2006, and they thought that was a credible source. But in fact, what you really want to know is how good a piece of data is. And we've all been kind of ignoring that in the last couple of years, but we don't know how credible people are, we don't know how good information is, and we don't understand where things are in time, which is another important attribute. So you know, you have things like Alexa and things like that giving us time slices, but I think we need those different attributes. We need reputation of the individuals, we need time attributes of the data, we need goodness, and all this stuff. I can see all these different companies playing with little pieces of this, from eBay's feedback to ePinions. I think there's a lot of this going on. Hecarati, for instance.
As we were preparing for this, you made a very interesting statement when I said, you know, I think one of the really hard things, besides a bad phone connection with Hong Kong where you were and San Francisco where I was, one of the really hard things is how can I fix data about myself? So if something is wrong about me somewhere and I find out about it, how can I fix it? And you predicted that in a couple of years there will be no wrong data about me anymore because somebody's got out there who's going to fix things.
Well, that's just you. I think the rest of us have a problem. But no, there are people now for a living, they go around and fix data. This has become a very interesting occupation.
So if you think about a company called GetSatisfaction.com in San Francisco, I just know them, no business relationship with them. GetSatisfaction, they have as their tagline, customer service is the new marketing. And what they provide is forums where people talk about products, about companies. And these are lively discussions. And then they offer to the companies, well, United Airlines, would you mind commenting on that issue? And it's up to the airline, in this case, where they want just to close their eyes and say, you know we do everything well and we were just wasting our time if we talk to customers, or whether they actually, in this focused forum, say, well, yeah, maybe we should spend some time fixing these things.
Yeah, I think that's the next wave of customer service systems. It's going to be banded groups of customers who are validated as high-end users or whatever, and that they'll be give fairly honest feedback. In fact, you can see that all over the place already.
And people are super good. Last year, I learned at the youth panel that people have good bullshit filters. That was just an extremely interesting insight I got. And that is really, really cool. One more question or one more comment?
Next day at the hospital had to apologize because all the nurses passed around his medical record.
Anything else? Yes, please.
As soon as some country, which could happen any day now, starts, you know, basically arresting people because of their blogs, I guess it has happened in a couple of cases now that I think about it, but there, you don't hear a lot about that. But when that starts happening, or in the US for instance, I mean, they've been flirting with that for years, ever since the Patriot Act. When people start going to jail or getting arrested or really can't get on an airplane because of some idiotic thing they said, you know, in Technorati a couple of months ago, then I think people are going to take it seriously again. It's just like the 9/11 thing. I mean, all that, the terrorism threat was always there, but it takes an event to make desensitize people and cause them to typically overreact.
Just one quick question. I totally agree with you about the whole idea of identity as currency. What business models do you see or do you imagine around this area? Is there anything? Is there any interesting companies you see doing things that put a price on privacy?
Yeah, I know a few. I actually started one just a couple months ago on pseudonymity that will allow people to manage pseudonymous identities within groups. I think you'll see a lot of that now that there's some standards. I think you'll see people who clean identities. I think you'll see reputation brokers. Imagine eBay's feedback rating apply across the whole internet. I think that's what you're going to see. And then what you're going to see is you're going to see identities being sold, bought and sold on eBay. Actually, you can see, start to see that already, I guess, don't you? One of the gaming things. So it's a whole great kind of a currency, because if you think about it, if you don't want your alias or your pseudonym broken, you can't take any money at all. If you want to protect your pseudonym, you can't show up somewhere to claim a prize, you can't take a check, you can't take a credit card, because if you do, you know, whoever they are, they're going to get you. So the only currency you have is reputation. Any company involving reputation, if they can hold on for the next few years, I think they're going to do very well.
So on that note, I think of reputation, let me actually thank the two people with an awesome reputation here, Ola and Mats, for inviting us here to do the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We are extremely happy with everything we've learned so far. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have about 7 minutes before we're going to get thrown out by Orup and Lena Peho, who's going to have a show here in 50 minutes or something like that. Martin Rosowski had to leave urgently, so he sends his regards, and he said instead of him wrapping up, he sent you a gift. Do we have a gift from Martin here?